Don't waste a moment of your life. Don't waste time. You'll never get it back.
Hi there. Welcome back to the Wild Business Growth Podcast. This is your place to hear from a new entrepreneur every single Wednesday morning who's turning wild ideas into wild growth. I'm your host, Max Brandstetter, founder and podcast producer at Malk's Paul Klostein, founder and podcast producer at Max Podcasting. And you can email me at max@maxpodcasting.com to save time with your high-quality podcast. This is episode Austin 316, and today's guest is Tom Kubinick. Tom is the president and CEO of Securit Tactical, the global leader in military weapon storage and armory design. In this episode, we cover how in the world Tom started working with the military, how to grow your business with a focus on simplicity and innovation, and that 2,000-foot ice climb in the Canadian Rockies. It is TK. Enjoy the show. Alrighty, we are here with Tom Kubinick, a name who I've rehearsed swimmingly, president and owner of Securit Tactical, a business that I don't even need to do the research. It's very unique compared to some of the previous businesses we found had on the show. So pretty exciting to speak with you today, Tom. Tom, thank you so much for joining. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, man. I'm looking forward to the podcast. And let's have a fun conversation.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to get to all things with Securit Tactical. But before that, I found a fun fact about you that I cannot leave said stone unturned. You were, and maybe still consider yourself, a heavy metal guitarist.
Yeah, I played on the road for about 10 years, 10, 12 years.
Like many people and like yourself, I love guitar. I've played it a little bit. Unfortunately, there's like a guitar behind me right now that I don't touch nearly as much as I really should and should get back into it. But what's the difference between being like a heavy metal guitarist and like what comes to mind when people think of a guitarist?
I do the style of music. I mean, when you say, I played in bands that were heavy metal bands. I've played in a big band, swing band. I played in a jazz band. I played in blues bands. I've done TV show work, like in a studio doing soundtracks for TV shows. So it's back in the 80s, playing in a metal band was the most fun. I mean, it was the time. I had a ball. I started playing guitar in high school, didn't go to college, and I was playing in bars when I was 17, you know, well underage, continued doing that. And I graduated high school in 1980, and then I got obsessed with playing guitar. You know, I was playing 6 to 10 hours a day. My parents kicked me out of the house because that's all I did. A guy at Guitar Player Magazine heard one of my demos, and they did an article on me as the best unknown guitar player that they had heard. So I'd never been signed, wasn't in any major bands, but I got this article in Guitar Player Magazine, and all of a sudden the phone was ringing, and I packed up, moved to Hollywood, and I attended MI, Musicians Institute, for 1 year to polish up on stuff, and I could already play pretty damn good, and meet a lot of people, finished that up, and then started playing, and I developed tendonitis shortly thereafter, and at a point when I was ready to, go audition for Ozzy and just be this rock star, I couldn't play anymore. And that was the end of it. And it happened pretty quick, and it was pretty brutal. And it took me about a year of hoping it would get better, and it just never did. So after a year after that, I took a job telemarketing typewriter ribbons because they would hire anybody. That job, they moved me to a non-sales position because I was so bad at it, but the guy thought I worked hard. I quit and took a straight commission job telemarketing computer supplies, immersed myself in the world of sales, and said, I'm going to sink or I'm going to swim. I got to figure something out. It took me 2 years to get pretty good at telemarketing. I quit and started my own company with two partners in a little apartment in a lousy neighborhood. And it was Panorama City outside of Los Angeles. It was a bad neighborhood. But we had this little business. A year and a half later, we had 18 sales reps, and that was my first company. Sold it, started another company, sold that, and eventually started Securit. And now we are the global leader in military weapon storage and armory design services. And in the consumer world, we're the fastest growing, one of the fastest growing companies in the hunting and outdoor sports area. So it's been kind of a crazy ride.
Well, just as you predicted, you're a star in the heavy metal space, but working with like literally heavy metal items. So you kind of packed your way into it. But
yeah.
Tendonitis, any itis is a bitch, by the way. I'm surprised you don't hear that more often. Like, I appreciate you sharing your story there. I'm surprised more guitar, and maybe there are, like, once you get into the space, guitarists that end up having tendonitis or guitar wrist or guitar elbow, however you want to call it.
It's not that common in guitar, but I was playing, I was working on Paganini's Caprice on violin for guitar, which incredibly fast technical pieces, and I was doing it like a workout at a gym. Only I was going at this, you know, 3 hours, 2 hours every single day. And if you go to the gym a lot, you know, if you do legs really hard on Monday, you don't do legs again until Thursday because your muscles need time to recover. And I didn't realize that. And I just was basically destroying my arms over time. However, I've had tendonitis now for almost most of my life. A year and a half ago, out of frustration, because I'm a golfer. I was a 6 handicap golfer. I became a pretty good golfer. And my tendonitis all of a sudden flared up bad and I couldn't play golf anymore. So I actually developed my own treatment device. I call it the arm bar. It's a trigger point therapy device, which I've got an engineer working on right now. I'm going to get a patent for it. And I'm going to market it with I want to teach people how to treat yourself for chronic tendonitis, which is different than acute tendonitis. The medical world is wrong. They treat it wrong. Besides health insurance, I've probably spent $75,000 out of pocket on every possible way to try to cure this. And I've now cured myself of it. And it's simple, but it's just not what you think. I took a deep dive on this and spent a year of just researching and reading and learning a lot. So that'll be something I'm going to launch and do, not as a moneymaker, more as a just helping people out. Because I listen to these stories and the doctors are just wrong.
Shout out all the doctors who tuned into the show that are punching me. Yeah, well, no, I'm just kidding. I mean,
I'm self-directed healthcare. I don't go to doctors anymore. I had a lot of health issues in my life, and I took charge of my own healthcare 2.5 years ago when my liver was failing, my blood pressure was through the roof, my arthritis was so bad, I couldn't use my hands. I had so many things just going sideways, and medical was just, try this pill, try that pill. And I switched my diet after doing a lot of research to pure carnivore. I eat red meat and water and nothing else. I take no pills of any kind. I'm not taking a pain pill. I had shoulder surgery for an injury skiing, which they did give me some sort of Oxycontin. But no, other than that, I have not taken a medication, and I don't. I do my own blood work. I use ChatGPT. I said, here, I type it all in. I say, write my report for a 62-year-old male, 168 pounds, in good health, boom, boom. And I do all my own health care. And not a doctor, no training, but I've never been more healthy in my life. Crazy.
So this is where we say, Tom is secretly a doctor, and this is all medical advice. No, I'm just kidding.
This is non-medical advice. This is, you know, you do you. I found what works for me. I don't know of anybody my age that's got more energy than I do.
Let's get to Securit Tactical. And I think to do that, we have to kind of touch on your previous business. Like, what was it that, like, you know, that phone call or email that made the jump for you into, like, the weapons and armory space?
It's interesting because I had sold my first company. Then I started my second company. It was Greenline Data, which was a telemarketing computer supply company. In the late 90s, I got into the internet was brand new, and I taught myself HTML. I had at that time probably 10 sales reps working for me, and I was spending most of my time writing websites and learning. And basically, I just taught myself how to make websites, and I started registering domains and making websites for all sorts of products. Instead of sourcing a product and try to sell it, I was making websites and seeing if I could get hits on things. I had crossbow.com, online supply, I had all these different websites, and taperack.com started getting leads for people looking for racks to store tapes. Back in the day, a company would have a big computer system and you'd back it up on these little tapes, and they weren't high capacity. So companies would have thousands of tapes that had to be stored and organized, and then these big metal racking systems for doing it. And TapeRack.com, over the course of 2 years, became one of the largest sellers of tape racks in the country. HIPAA laws came out, so I created SecureLaptopStorage.com, hospital. This was the laws that required hospitals to lock up all personal data, all, you know, patient data. So all the laptops had to be locked every night. So SecureLaptopStorage.com and PoweredLaptopStorage.com became wildly popular, and we sold millions of dollars in laptop storage to hospitals. And it was that website that I got a phone call once, and a guy said, "Hey, can you store an MP5? I'm like, "Sure. What's an MP5? I'm thinking a computer. He goes, "It's a little submachine gun." And I started laughing. I go, "Who is this?" And he was with the FBI. And I said, "You know, I'm sure we could." I talked to him for about 20 minutes. And I said, "Give me a week and let me do a little research." And I called a guy named Steve Moulton, who he owned the company that was making my laptop cabinets. I said, "Steve, I got something crazy for you. What do you think about trying to make weapon racks?" He started laughing. He said, "Tom, I'm already working on a design for the Canadian government." His company was based out of Canada. So we shared notes and we came together with a design. This was in 2002. Now, Securit at the time was Secure IT selling laptops. It was a brand for my laptop cabinets.
I was going to say, because I researched this part, I was like, is it IT or it?
It was originally actually, Secure IT. And then we started doing the weapon storage and it became Secure. The weapon, it was slow into it. It's a steep learning curve doing government contracting. We knew nothing about this. And I was a dealer for a Canadian company making weapon racks. I shared a lot of design work with him. He and I did a lot of work together, but he owned that company and we were a dealer. That was in 2002. 2007, we became aware of a contract that was about to be put out, solicitation. U.S. Army Special Forces Command wanted to hire a company to survey all their armories and prepare a detailed report as to why they're failing all their inspections. We heard about this through the grapevine and secured a meeting with a colonel down in Fort Bragg. We're a three-person company at this point. Gary Myrick, my sales guy, and I flew down there, and you know, we had no idea what we were doing, but we had nothing to lose. So we're walking into this, you know, we got our hotel, we're like, are our shirts white enough? Do we look good? Can we do this? Walking through this base and into these offices, I think it was third group, U.S. Army Special Forces group, into the colonel's office, and it just hit me as I'm walking through the hallways, and I walked into his office, introduced myself, and just said, "Good evening, sir. My name's Tom Kubinek. I'm considered the leading authority in small arms storage and armory design, and I think my company Secured is the company to do this for you." And Gary introduced himself. We sat down. We talked for 20 minutes. We left, and Gary's out in the parking lot. He goes, "What the hell was that?" I looked at him. I started laughing. He goes, "Leading authority?" And I started laughing. I said, "Gary, nobody knows how to do this. No, there's no company that does this. We just walked in to the guy and said, we are the pros from Dover. Nobody can refute us." And that's a business lesson. If there is no expert in your field, you can claim it. Now, you got to back it up. But we simply claimed to be the best, and there was nobody out there. We won the contract. We were up against like L3 and Harris. And these big companies probably put millions of dollars on their bid. We came in at probably $500,000 of actual. I mean, it was very economical what we were able to do. And for 18 months, I traveled all over the country. I spent a day in each armory with the armorer, lots of photographs, shot video, got interviewed these guys, watched the workflow. And over the course of that 18 months, I became the leading authority on small arm storage and armory design. And it was during that time that we designed and patented our tactical weapon storage platform, what we simply call Cradle Grid now. And that was patented in 2008. By 2011, we were the primary supplier to the U.S. military. When it just took off. In 2010, I bought my first gun. I'd never owned a gun. And I designed the system having never owned a gun. My very first design I'd done having never seen an armory. In this case, you know, people say you're really thinking outside the box. I'm just like, guys, we didn't even know there was a box. You know, we were so far removed from this.
You're reinventing the box.
Well, we came into it. We didn't know what we were doing. So we just said, people are looking at weapon stores and weapon racks, and we're just saying, we're storing basically metal pipes. with a lot of gear. And we went to Home Depot and just started walking the aisles looking at stuff. I called it Home Depot development. And our idea was, don't make it proprietary. Make it compatible with as many things in the world as possible. So our Cradle Grid system, we have a patented storage system for the guns, but then for all the gear, and that's the hardest part, we supply storage bins, but they can go to Home Depot, any hardware store, and buy storage bins, baskets, trays that will go into the rack and adjust very easily. My competitors in the space were all proprietary. We crushed them because of that level of flexibility. And again, we designed something to make the warfighter safer and better prepared, not something to guarantee us more business. And I think that, you know, when you operate out of what is the absolute best thing you can do for your customer is a much better way to build a business than what is the absolute best thing we can do for profit. I mean, yes, you want to generate a profit, but you broadly, you, the companies that win big because everything they do is designed around customer satisfaction first, and then making sure it's profitable before they really launch it.
Yeah, there's some great lessons there. It's funny, totally different space, but like your lesson about claiming the space and being like, hey, I'm the person here, and then continuing to build around that. You know, way back in, it was around episode 50, we had Sue B. Zimmerman on, who is like the Instagram expert. Like she, however you say it, I'm so bad at these things, made her claim, and like said one year early on in the era of Instagram, hey, I am the Instagram expert. And she literally has like built her entire business and like career off of that. And so totally different space, but it's, if you do it confidently, and in your case to a kernel, it can do some wonderful things.
The thing that a lot of people, I mean, you gotta realize is your customers, if you know, if they don't know your company well, if they're unsure, people don't want to make a bad decision. And they don't want to think, wow, I mean, again, I wasted my money. It really comes back to, I made a stupid decision. And if they're trying to choose what business for a level of service, when they see somebody, a persona or something on a website saying the leading authority and whatever it is, an example, I've got a friend that had a business, high pressure hoses and hydraulic fittings, and they custom made on the, you know, real quick turnaround for factories for people that had to keep equipment running. And I said, take one of your techs, get a cool photograph of him and just put, you know, his name had put considered the leading authority in high pressure hoses, and talk about how long he's been with your firm and why your firm is better, but build it around a persona. So when people see the website or see, they're just going to say, oh, the dude works here, I got to buy from here. You can do it. I mean, if there is no authority, the first person to claim it typically is the authority. Maybe it takes a little bit of guts or balls or whatever you want to call it, but you know what?
Yeah. Well, I'll give you credit for both of those in that story. You mentioned Cradle Grid, and for anybody who's not as familiar, and like I know next to nothing about guns, basically. In the military context, like what benefit does like Cradle Grid, for example, provide for like a military unit compared to like how they used to operate?
Okay, so what we do, the military transition from an M16 Vietnam era battle rifle to the M4 during the Gulf War. The M4 is a modular, really a weapon system. A lot of different attachments. You can configure the gun in many different ways. The form factor changes, especially in special forces, per operator. Also, you've got a whole lot of high-value gear associated with soldiers, from night vision to thermal imaging to radios, to all this technology, and that all has to be locked in the armory because it's such high-value or secret-type gear. So armories from Vietnam coming into the Gulf War were all simple metal frames holding all the same size gun and no gear. All of a sudden, this change happened, and I had two competitors that were making weapon racks that were modular racks, and inside the rack, you had all these different brackets for all the different guns, and you had all these different bins for all the different gear. One competitor had a rack system with 125 different components. The other one was 270 different components. And when they build an armory, it's perfect. But the minute something changes, the army has to go back to that company and buy the new bracket or buy the to hold that gun. And military spending doesn't work that way. Contracting doesn't work that way. So what happens is they end up making do with what they have, and the racks slowly become worse and worse as the parts are mismatched. And you end up with what we call a bird's nest, which is just a mess of guns and gear packed into these boxes. Cradle Grid is one moving part. It's one patented piece that will hold everything from the smallest submachine gun up to a 50 cal machine gun and like big shoulder launch, a Carl Gustav and shoulder launch weapon systems. One piece adjusts on the fly with no tools. So the armorer can walk up to the cabinet with a gun in hand, whether it's a small rifle, a machine gun, or something larger, adjust the rack, put the gun in it, and walk away on the fly instantly. Nobody else had ever been able to do that. And then all the gear we supplied to simple plastic bins and trays that are available at Home Depot for all the gear. And that gave the armorer the ability to take each one of our weapon cabinets and configure it to do exactly what they want. The Marine Corps out at Pendleton called it the Tetris rack. They start at the bottom and just building. And then the guys at third group called it the Lego rack because it was like Legos. And we'd set up racks for these guys, build this whole armory out, per some specs and get it all done, say, this is absolutely perfect. I'd come back to a walkthrough 3 months later and it's completely changed because the armorer's like, oh, dude, no, I changed this. Look, by putting this over here and I can do this. They had the freedom. The armorers had the freedom to do whatever they wanted. And in the military, how those guns are stored are critical because that's one of the highest activity areas. Issuing and returning guns can be a real bottleneck, especially like for a security force unit. If you're doing base security, like an Air Force base, they do a shift change. They got 20 guys coming in, 20 guys going out, and all these guns are passing through this window in this armory. You know, I've seen armories where it takes them 45 minutes to do a shift change. With my system, it takes 3 to 5. You know, we're just saving them so much time. And then our system properly stores the gun, so nothing is ever touching. If you're not a rifle, if you're a gun guy, you zero a rifle, meaning you got a rifle with a very high-powered scope, like a sniper rifle. You've got that thing dialed in so the scope absolutely matches where that bullet is going. If that gets hit, gets banged in, if something hits it, you could lose that zero. When a sniper goes into combat, he has one chance to make one shot. And if he misses, people get killed. I mean, it's critical that his equipment performs perfectly, and our system pretty much guaranteed that. As I got more into this, I became fascinated with some of the science around it and all the stuff that these guys were doing. And, you know, I didn't serve in the military, but I thought, here's a way that I can make a contribution. So we just kept honing this system and spending a lot of time with operators, just giving them a system that allows them to be as safe as possible, as flexible as possible, and basically put them in a position to win.
Yeah, can you expand on that? Like what's your research process look like in terms of developing new products and like making things sharper and more efficient and safer?
It's funny. It's just the opposite of what everybody listening would think.
You play some guitar.
Our process is out of simplicity. I reduce things down. I'm a big believer. Anybody can make a complex system that solves a problem. But when you look, the simplest solutions are the one to withstand the test of time. An example, if you got a junk drawer in your kitchen, that one with all the, usually a pair of pliers, duct tape, a screwdriver, people keep the simplest tools handy because you can solve the most problems. So we look at weapon storage, we want to make the simplest tool possible so it can solve the most problems. How we do product development. So Marine Corps puts out a solicitation. We won the contract to rebuild Okinawa. It was an $8 million project. And it is taking our system into what they're going to call Armory of the Future. And we're looking at about $256 million contract with the Marine Corps, which would be huge for us. We're still working out the logistics of trying to make this thing work. But we had our system, and we're putting these proposals together for this Okinawa project. And the gunnery sergeant, Master Gunnery Sergeant Okinawa, is like, Tom, no, stop. I want the guns to snap into the rack. They got to snap in so they can't fall. Yeah, well, you want this? He goes, they got to snap in. How are we going to solve this problem? Now, I've got three other companies bidding on this. They all took months to figure out how to snap guns in. I sent out two groups of two. I said, go to Lowe's, go to Home Depot, look in the broom aisle. I want to find things that will hold brooms against a wall. Just things that we push a broom in or rakes. Look at garage stuff. I want something that'll just snap it against the wall, buy whatever they've got and bring it here. We got all these different brackets and components that, have you seen those things where you push it on a wall and the little rollers close? Okay, so we found this 3M product. This is kind of cool. So I cut it and I went and glued it and just butchered it. We call these Franken brackets onto one of our saddles. And then I took, bondoed it, sanded it down, cleaned it up a little bit, painted it black, and shot a video of it with a gun snapping in. And I sent it to the master gunnery sergeant. He took that video and sent it out. It went viral through the Marine Corps, and they just lit up. And so now we won the contract. I said, okay, so we've got a 3M proprietary piece glued onto one of our pieces. Now we got to make one of these that actually works. So we took the concept there, and we went to an, I actually brought in an outside engineer saying, who's a on the industrial side of engineering. He said, yeah, Tom, what you want is a wire form. Using our existing bracket, we were able to use a wire form piece with two rollers, and it's still a piece we sell all the time now. And it came out perfect. It was really simple, but all of our product development always traces back to what is the actual thing we're trying to solve? What's the simplest way to solve it? Okay, define that. Now, how do we make this into something that's ergonomic, that's pleasing to look at, that doesn't require directions? And that's where things get harder. Sometimes the simplest solution tells us, you know what, we don't need to make a product for this. We need to educate people that it already exists. We've done that before with some of the stuff we do. We're like, hey, Tom, I want to store this and this and this. Yeah, aisle four at Home Depot, they actually have it. Again, we're not going to make a product that already exists. That's not what's how, you know, secure it. We're known for being very innovative, but it's really just the most efficient, simplest way to achieve an outcome. You know, in this case, it's storage. Again, in the consumer world, consumer products is now 85% of our business. It's the fastest growing part of our business. We were Inc. Magazine's fastest growing companies in America twice in 3 years. And that was all consumer growth. You know, the gun safe industry has been around since the 60s. And they're all the same. And we come at it with this radically different way of doing guns. You know, gun safes are heavy. Our safes are lightweight and ultra lightweight. Everything we do is in conflict with what a gun safe is. You know, in this case, our sale is trying to educate people that everything you know is a lie. Everything you've been told is wrong. It's gun safes have been this way forever. Not because it's the best way. It's just because they have. So we're really challenging people, challenging the status quo on what is the best way to store guns in your home. And as it works out, a big, heavy gun safe in your basement is a really bad way to do it. You know, we would prefer small, lightweight, modular safes located throughout your home. You know, somebody comes into my house, you would never know that I own firearms. Yet I can be armed in 2.5 to 3 seconds. Again, we're coming into the consumer products strictly from everything we learned from 20 years of military. And everything we do is based on that level of performance. And we're saying, no, it makes no sense. Do it this way. It makes more sense. Here's why. And we're winning the battle. We are, I'm hoping we're going to get to a tipping point. Have you ever read Malcolm Gladwell's book,
The Tipping Point? Yeah. Oh, that's classic.
I think that we're approaching a tipping point with what we do because we spent very little on advertising, yet we're growing like crazy. It's all word of mouth. You know, getting the right, what was the term he used for them? The communicators, the people that would bridge all this communication and getting the right buzz going. I see it happening. And there's a point we're going to struggle to get to 9% market. And the market's going to, basically, we're going to struggle to get to 35, 40 million. And then the market will chase us to 100. Because that's when we go from early adopter buyers to your majority, your early majority, late majority, is right around 9 to 11% market penetration for a new product coming into a market. And we're just about there.
Well, congrats on the growth and all the incredible innovation. I think simplicity is always a good smart route to go. Simplicity and efficiency. You know, there's a lot of huge businesses that have been built on that. So it's really cool to hear that's, you know, a core principle for you as well.
Innovate. When you walk in here, the first sign you see is innovate and simplify. And I just talk to people about all the time is, again, anybody can make complexity. The beauty of what Jobs did with Apple was he came up with the iPhone. There were no directions. Just use it. I gave my mom an iPad. You know, she's in her 70s. I go, Mom, just use it. There's no directions. Just use it. And you come back a day later and they're just using it. And that's the beauty of that system, the simplicity. There's always ways in every business to make things easier to understand or easier to use. And I think consumers, they might not talk about it, but they appreciate it.
Well, in the spirit of simplifying things, if I could pronounce simplifying, let's wrap up with some rapid fire Q&A. You ready for it?
Sure.
All right. Short and sweet. Let's get wild. What is the hardest song to cover on guitar that you've ever attempted?
Acoustic. I do a fingerstyle version of Layla by Eric Clapton. I'm playing the melody and the rhythm at the same time on acoustic guitar.
Whoa,
and I'm playing the piano part at the end. It's on, if you YouTube Kubinik Layla Dad, D-A-D-G-A-D, it's out there. I practiced that religiously for 2 years before I could play it.
Oh my God. I'm picturing you like an octopus now. Like you got so many tentacles at the same time.
I recorded that for a guitar I was actually selling. I wanted people to hear what it was. A Goodall, a very, very high and fine guitar. I just recorded that song and threw it out as part for the sell the guitar. And then I put it on YouTube. I was like, people like, hey, dude, that's awesome. It is out there.
All right. What is your favorite military movie or TV show of all time?
Oh, military! Yeah, there's so many good military movies.
Or war movie. Call it war movies. More common.
Yeah, war movies. Kelly's Heroes. Clint Eastwood. It's a comedy, black comedy movie. Brilliantly done. That'd probably be the one that I would still. I don't watch a lot of TV, but I'll sit and watch that one for a while.
We'll give it to you. All right. What is a band that, or performer who's probably no longer performing in concert anymore, but who you wish they could come back so you could see him live again, or just live in general?
It'd be Jimi Hendrix, without doubt.
Oh yeah.
People don't realize how far ahead he was, what he was doing, and it wasn't until very much more recently. Uli Roth, early guitarist with Scorpions in the '80s, and now his solo career, he's getting pretty old, is the only guy that has approached what Hendrix was doing.
That's a great answer. I'll go like, I don't know, months or a year without listening to Jimi Hendrix. And then when it comes on shuffle, I'll be like, oh my God, I need to listen to his entire catalog again.
Who's close is Stevie Ray Vaughan, who's respected as a great blues guitarist.
Oh, one of my dad's favorites.
From a technical standpoint, his command of the keyboard goes way beyond blues. And I mean, I was pretty critical of most guitar players. I was known for super technical, super clean playing, and I can't play his stuff. I can't play Hendrix's stuff. I mean, I can play the notes, but I can't sound like that. I just don't have it. There's a magic there.
It's hard to not put a smile on your face when you're just listening to Stevie Ray Vaughan. Like, there's just some like the best vibes with it. All right, and then last one. You're a big skier, hiking, all sorts of outdoor stuff. What's like the craziest outdoor adventure that you've ever been on?
North face of Mount Athabasca.
I was going to guess that. I just couldn't pronounce that. No, I'm just kidding.
That's a 2,000-foot ice climb in the Canadian Rockies I did in 1991. And it was I was a rock climber into that. That was my first big ice climb, climbing with a Brit who was one of England's top mountaineers. He happened to be dating my business partner. And it was it's a moment that changed. There's a moment on that mountain that changed my life forever. That was I was either going to survive or I was not going to survive. And it was a very dangerous situation. And I was by myself. And it's a longer story, but there's a point where all of a sudden I got scared because if I fall, I got a rope going to me, but the guy had topped out. He was off to the side, 45 degrees that way. He could not hear me. The wind's howling. If I fall, I'm going to swing, hit a wall of rock and ice, be hanging, and there's no way he'd lift me over this cornice of ice. So I knew I couldn't fall, and I had to climb, I had to top out, meaning top of this, I'm on ice above me, I'm reaching above my head and just sliding this axe, and it's got a hook on something, I got to commit to it. So I'm sitting there, I started getting nervous, and a voice came over and just said, it's worth it. And it hit me just like that. I calmed right down, I pulled a camera out of my pocket, shot two images over my shoulder off this mountain, put the camera back. It was a little film camera. Reached up with the axe, slid it. You know, I couldn't see what I was doing. It's over the top of this ledge, slid it, and it hooked on something. Put the other axe up there, walked my feet up, cantilever, and, you know, pulling like crazy on these axes. If they'd popped, I would have been done. And got up, and I never mentioned that to Kevin. I just got up, topped out, walked up. We hiked down. It took us about 3 hours to hike down. And that's really the last time in my life I was ever afraid of anything. And I've never been afraid of anything. I don't do stupid things, but fear doesn't keep me from doing anything. I have the two photos still. I have one of them I framed. And it's not a great photo. Nobody knows why I have it, but it's mine.
That is out of this world and takes me back to one of my favorite movies when I was a kid. Kind of one of the first more, call it adult or grown up, scary, extreme movies was it's a movie in the 90s called Vertical Limit. I don't know if you ever saw that. Well, it's like
Vertical Limit was.
I forget who was in it, but it was. There were scenes like that where it's like
it wasn't. There wasn't with Sylvester Stallone, was it?
I think that was
a cheesier one.
I don't think so.
I was way into climbing back then. I remember the movies coming out.
Chris O'Donnell. Oh, Bill Paxton was in it.
Okay. Yep.
Scott Glenn.
Bill Paxton was probably. I don't watch a lot of movies. I don't pay attention to Hollywood, but Bill Paxton was definitely. Has to be one of my top five and favorite actors to watch. I miss him. He was.
Yeah, he's in legendary stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Real quick, when you're on the side of that ice cliff there, was there something that you like told yourself to kind of.
No, I sat there. I get to the top and there's a rock ledge coming over my head about 4 inches. Not much, but I just got to reach up around it blindly and hook these axes on something. And I just sat there and all of a sudden I started getting real scared going, shit. Kevin can't hear me. I can't get to him. If I fall, I'm screwed. And a voice it said, it's worth it. It's so clear in my head. I don't know where it came from, but I just completely calmed down, settled right down, sat there for a minute, enjoyed the view, took my photographs, reached up over my head with one of the axes, slid it through the snow. And the axe has a little cleat on the front that loops like back facing you almost. And it caught. I said, all right. So I let go of the other axe. Now I'm committed. Reach the other arm up, and then as I walked my feet up, you know, you're cantilevering, so the farther your feet come up, the harder you're pulling on your arms on these little chips. And I just kind of pulled myself, so I'm laying on my stomach on top of this ledge, and worked my way up and walked up to the top of the mountain. And, I don't know what the other outcomes could have been, but we only got one
probably
shot.
Probably better not to think about it, yeah.
As far as we know, we got one shot at life. I live now is I just don't waste time. I don't watch TV. I don't do the internet much. I'm out. I've got a hunting. We got a 500-acre, the Secure Ranch, we call it. And I'm out there a lot. I like spend time outdoors.
But think how many Bill Paxton movies you could watch if you watch more TV. No, I'm just kidding.
There you go. I do miss my... No, it was Alien, the second Alien movie. He was just brilliant.
Tom, congrats on all the growth and all the innovation. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story and tips and near death experiences on a mountain. So pretty crazy stuff. But where's the best place if anybody wants to learn more about SecureIt or to connect with you online? Where do you want to point them?
Just Google SecureIt. Google my name, Tom Kubinek. I come up all over the place. And with the name Kubinek, I'm related to every one of them, so it's not hard to get SEO.
And am I spelling this right? Kubinieck. IEC. Oh, I messed
up. IEC. That's the one that gives everybody goofed up. That section, that I. But then they just Google SecureIt, and we're all over the web. But yeah, I appreciate the opportunity, and it's been fun.
Yeah, appreciate it. Back at you. Last thing, final thoughts. It could be a quote, words to live by, whatever you want. Just kind of one line to send us home here.
Don't waste a moment of your life. Don't waste time. You'll never get it back.
Way to not waste the final thoughts. Thank you so much, Tom, for coming on the podcast, sharing your wild story. And thank you, wild listeners, for tuning in to another episode. If you want to hear more wild stories like this one, make sure to follow the Wild Business Growth Podcast on your favorite podcast app and subscribe on YouTube. YouTube is at Max Brandstetter. You can also find us on Good Pods, and for any help with podcast production, you can learn more at maxpodcasting.com and sign up for the Podcasting to the Max newsletter. That is at maxpodcasting.com/newsletter. Until next time, let your business run wild.
Bring on the bongos!